This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, a status update on Afghanistan. What does the resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan portend for the future of that pivotal country? Will U.S. President Barack Obama reverse his position on withdrawing the bulk of U.S. troops by 2016, as his top commander is recommending? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. What a difference a week makes. The Taliban had captured Kunduz, a strategically located city of 300,000 in the country's north, on September 28th, and 7 days later, Afghan security forces retook the city. The Taliban attack on Kunduz was significant because it marked the first time since the war began in 2001 that a major city had fallen to the Taliban. However, during efforts by Afghan security forces and U.S. Special Operations Forces, a U.S. airstrike accidentally bombed a hospital run by the charity Doctors Without Borders, which killed 22 people. After conflicting reports about who was ultimately responsible and if the attack was intentional on the basis that the Taliban had been using the hospital as a shield or was a tragic mistake, U.S. General John Campbell, who commands U.S. and allied forces in Afghanistan, asserted that the United States bore ultimate responsibility for authorizing the strike. However, General Campbell said the United States would never deliberately target a medical facility. Meantime, U.S. President Barack Obama has promised a thorough and transparent investigation into the bombing of the field hospital. And in a phone call Wednesday, the president apologized to the head of Doctors Without Borders for the Kunduz bombing. He also called Afghanistan's president to express condolences for the civilian deaths. Well, with us to discuss the significance of the Taliban's temporary capture of Kunduz, the fallout from the U.S. airstrike on the field hospital, and the future of the U.S. troop level in Afghanistan are two distinguished analysts who are frequent voices at these VOA microphones. Lisa Curtis is Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. That's a think tank based here in Washington, and Michael Kugelman. He's Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia in the Asia Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, also based here in Washington. And both panelists join us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Lisa Curtis, let me begin with you and talk about the very tragic strike on the hospital in Kunduz. President Obama now has apologized for this tragic airstrike that killed 22 patients. He said that the United States will examine military procedures to try to minimize or avoid such accidents in the future. Besides this tragic loss of life and infrastructure, how damaging is this incident for the United States' image and credibility around the world and for U.S.-Afghan relations?
Well, I think it's a horrific tragedy, and I'm happy that President Obama has apologized to the president of Doctors Without Borders, as well as President Ghani of Afghanistan, but he should have probably done it even sooner. I think there are a lot of questions that need to be answered about what exactly happened. We're hearing from Doctors Without Borders that they had provided coordinates of their location to the ISAF headquarters just days before the bombing. So there are many questions that need to be answered. However, I don't think that the U.S. will consent to this idea that the president of Doctors Without Borders has raised to have the International Humanitarian Fact-Finding Commission, which was established by the Geneva Conventions, to have this investigative body conduct an investigation. The U.S. has said there are three separate investigations that will happen. One is a NATO investigation, one is a joint U.S.-Afghan investigation, and the other is a Department of Defense investigation. So from the U.S. perspective, I think they will focus on these three investigations and will not consent to this idea of an international investigation. And this is mainly because if any legal action were to be contemplated against any U.S. soldiers, that would have to be decided within the U.S. And so I think that, you know, there's just no way that the U.S. can consent to some kind of international investigation about what happened. But that said, I think the U.S. needs to come out quickly with thorough investigation. They need to be very public and very honest about what happened. They owe this to Doctors Without Borders, who was performing vital medical assistance there in Afghanistan. And also the U.S. has to do something about the fact that now Doctors Without Borders has pulled out. So the U.S. should compensate somehow that loss of that medical assistance that was there.
Turning to you, Michael Kugelman, for your take on this terrible tragedy, the same question beside this tragic loss of life and infrastructure, how damaging do you think this incident is for the United States, for U.S.-Afghan relations, and really for the U.S. image around the world? And do you agree with Lisa that an independent review, as recommended by Doctors Without Borders, in addition to the U.S.-Afghan, the NATO, and the Department of Defense investigations into this strike, is really warranted or not?
I completely agree with Lisa that this attack was a horrible tragedy, and I think that President Obama should ideally have apologized several hours after it happened, not several days, which was the case. I mean, essentially, it came down to one of two scenarios. I think that either the United States attacked the hospital not realizing that it was a hospital, which would be a gross intelligence failure, or the other possibility is that the U.S. attacked the hospital knowing it was a hospital, but essentially attacked it in a way assuming that it would be hitting targets not in the hospital, outside of it, because apparently the Taliban was thought to be operating within the vicinity. And that would, of course, signify very questionable rules of engagement on the part of the United States. But whatever the case may be, you know, you had asked about the implications for the U.S.-Afghanistan relationship. I would actually argue that it will not be that costly. And that's because the overall bilateral relationship is much better now than it was when President Karzai was in power. In fact, in cases when the U.S. military done things that caused civilian casualties, there would be a tremendous response from President Karzai, and that would lead to protests in the streets in Afghanistan, whereas the reaction has been much more subdued this time around. President Ghani, of course, is a big proponent of keeping the U.S. in Afghanistan for a long time. You know, there was no condemnation from the government, and I've heard very little examples of protests. And of course, by contrast, you know, when Karzai was in power, he and Obama simply did not get along. So if this had happened during the Karzai administration, it would have plunged the relationship into a deeper crisis than it had already been in when Karzai was in power. Turning to the issue of a commission, it's tough to say. I would argue that perhaps an investigation put into place by the U.S. or the Afghan governments may not be particularly impartial or credible, given that the U.S. and the Afghan governments that were involved in this incident. So some form of international investigation would be warranted in terms of how it proceeds and who does it exactly. I don't know, but I'm certainly a supporter of having an in-depth, transparent investigation.
I agree with Michael. I think it is worth noting the muted response that we've seen in Afghanistan to this horrible tragedy. And I do think it shows the difference between President Ghani and President Karzai, and that he is cognizant of wanting to keep U.S. forces in Afghanistan and is therefore not going to play up such a tragedy for his own political advantage, which we often saw President Karzai do. But another issue here is General Campbell, commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, has said that the strike was called in by the Afghans. Now, that doesn't absolve the U.S. from responsibility. It was obviously U.S. bombs that dropped on the hospital. But perhaps this has also something to do with the lack of condemnation from the Afghan side on the strike. Maybe there was some responsibility there as well.
A very interesting point by Lisa Curtis of the Heritage Foundation. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
We're back with Encounter. We're talking about the situation in Afghanistan, the temporary seizing of Kunduz by the Taliban, and the fallout from the airstrike on the hospital, as well as the future of U.S. troop levels there. Well, back to you, Lisa Curtis, to move on to U.S.-Afghan relations and this capture of Kunduz. Let's look back. How significant was it that the Taliban, after 14 years, was able to seize such an important strategically located city? What does that portend?
Well, I think it is important that this is the first city they've been able to take over. However, frankly, for people who are watching Afghanistan closely over the last year or so, it's not terribly surprising. The Taliban had been building up in this region. They had taken two key districts over the summer, so it looked like the city might fall then. So it's not terribly surprising that Kunduz did fall to the Taliban, at least temporarily. But it shows how important it is for the U.S. to remain in Afghanistan, to backstop the Afghan forces. The Afghan forces are fighting hard. They've taken record-level casualties this year. But the fact is, they still require international support, whether that be intelligence support, training, battlefield advice, critical air support. It's crucial that the U.S. remain some kind of presence in the country, even beyond 2016. And I think that the fall of Kunduz actually builds pressure on the White House to reconsider its current timeline for withdrawal, which, of course, is to go to zero troops by the end of 2016. So I think we will see a reconsideration of that decision and a recommitment to Afghanistan. So I think you will see the U.S. stepping up its commitment to Afghanistan. And despite the fact that President Obama wanted to be the president who ended two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, I don't see how that's possible at this point.
Turning to you, Michael Kugelman, for your take on the capture of Kunduz. I know you've written about this. How significant was it? And what about the signs leading up to the capture? Were they not heeded? Do you also agree that it could be an impetus for the United States to reconsider troop levels beyond 2016?
It's obvious how significant this was. The first time a major urban space was taken by the Taliban really crystallizes the fact that the Taliban remains a national threat. It is not simply a localized insurgency restricted to the south and the east, its traditional strongholds. This Kunduz seizure did not come out of nowhere. It had really been in the works for quite a few years. You've had the Taliban trying to build up a presence in Kunduz and in the surrounding region. And the Taliban has also been able to draw on the support of a lot of powerful militant friends in the neighborhood of northern Afghanistan. It's been able to work with, for example, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan and related outfits that have really helped it develop a pretty considerable presence in Kunduz and in surrounding districts. And really, over the last few years, there have been assaults and offensives on Kunduz and in the area. And I think that the Taliban has been able to go after the most vulnerable spots of Afghan security. There have been a lot of attacks on police forces in the region. Another issue is that the Afghan government has essentially outsourced a lot of security in Kunduz and the surrounding region to local militias and warlords. And, you know, it's been very difficult to depend on those groups to provide security, and in many cases, they have not. It was a shocking assault and a shocking seizure, but in some ways it wasn't, because we could have assumed that it would happen. And, you know, unfortunately, not only, you know, was this something in development for quite some time, but I fear that there could be more major Taliban victories in the northern Afghanistan region. So, you know, we've talked a lot about Kunduz. We're going to be talking about places like Baghlan, Badakhshan, other areas, particularly areas that are resource-rich, incidentally. So that's really something to worry about. I agree with Lisa that the United States really is in a position where it needs to retain a military presence in Afghanistan next year. Even before the Kunduz seizure, U.S. officials were increasingly concerned about the growing influence of ISIS in Afghanistan, particularly in the northeast. So that was a concern. But now with this Kunduz situation and this clear proof that the Taliban remains a threat, there are two very good reasons right there for the U.S. government to agree to keep several thousand troops in the country after this year.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Lisa Curtis, she's Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and Michael Kugelman, Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia in the Asia Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, from whom you just heard. We're talking about the significance and impact of the Taliban's temporary seizing of Kunduz and what it means for security and stability in Afghanistan. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You may also send an email to encounter@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Abdul Rahman Jibo, writing us from the Netherlands. Well, back to you, Lisa Curtis, to talk about the Afghan security forces, their level of readiness or lack thereof, the strength of the Taliban, the threat they still pose as a result of the capture of Kunduz, and as Michael Kugelman says, the potential for more strikes of this nature, which is very worrisome. So that brings us to the question of the strength of the Afghan security forces after all these years.
Well, I think Michael is right that there are other cities that are under threat, and the Taliban is not just making progress in Kunduz in the north. It's making progress in several different parts of Afghanistan. And this is a concern. And, you know, we knew it would be tough for the Afghan forces the first year after the U.S. and NATO forces are not involved in combat operations. So we were expecting them to face challenges, which they are. But what's interesting is the timing of all this. If you remember, over the summer, we had a lot of hope around the fact that the Taliban had met with the Afghan government in Pakistan. These were the Murray talks that took place in July. And people had a lot of hope that, you know, this was the first time they had really met face to face and perhaps things would move forward. Well, all of that was upset when the news was released of Mullah Omar's death, the fact that he had died 2 years ago. So the question now is the new Taliban leader, Mullah Akhtar Mansour, trying to consolidate his power over the movement because there has been dissension among the Taliban leaders about the succession following Mullah Omar? Is he trying to consolidate that power base, and can we expect him to go back to talks, or is the Taliban intent on pursuing a military victory and they'll stay on this path? I think there are a lot of questions out there. And what's Pakistan's involvement? Pakistan had used its influence to bring Mullah Mansour to the negotiating table in July. Presumably, Islamabad still has some influence over this new Taliban leader and could influence him to get back to the negotiating table. But will Pakistan do this? And I think this is where the U.S. comes in, because Pakistan is one of the largest U.S. aid recipients in the world. And we should be conditioning that aid on Pakistan working with the U.S. towards stabilizing Afghanistan. And we know that Pakistan has links to the Taliban leadership. So it's important that Pakistan use that influence to encourage the talks process.
Turning to you, Michael Kugelman, Lisa Curtis brings up a lot of very interesting and important questions with respect to the strength of the Afghan security forces, the strength of the Taliban, bringing in the historical points, the fact that Mullah Omar has been declared dead and we have a new Taliban leader, Mullah Akhtar Mansour. And what do these facts mean for the future? Do you think he wants to re-energize the Taliban to fight, or would he compromise and go to the peace table?
I mean, I think the default assumption would be that the Taliban would not want to come to the negotiating table because it's doing so well on the battlefield. Why give up its successes on the battlefield? And that could be true. But I think that there certainly is a flip side here, that the Taliban could conclude that it has a lot of leverage right now. It's on the offensive, literally, and that it would be a good time for the Taliban to come to the negotiating table and assume that it can get some pretty good concessions from the Afghan government, which one could assume is desperate for the war to end, because it's clear there's not going to be a battlefield solution. And Afghanistan cannot win this war militarily. So I think in that sense, there's a very good chance that the sides will return to the negotiating table. Mullah Mansour, the new leader of the Taliban, is known for being close to the Pakistani security establishment, and the Pakistani security establishment could easily get with him, so to speak, and try to work out an arrangement where he agrees to come to the negotiating table. My sense is that the Pakistanis do want a peace process to begin again. The Pakistanis are very intent on improving relations with Afghanistan more broadly. There were efforts earlier this year by the General Sharif, the Pakistani army chief, to reconcile a bit with the Afghan government, really because of a concern that Pakistani militants, the Pakistani Taliban, were using sanctuaries in Afghanistan to stage attacks on Pakistan's. And there has been a desire on the part of Pakistan to get Afghanistan to work with it, to do more about these militants. So the idea of having the Pakistanis Afghanis and the Afghans come together to talk about broader issues of reconciliation, particularly with the Taliban, I think would work very well. But then again, one never knows. There are different factions involved. You know, the leadership crisis that arose after Mullah Omar's death was formally announced, they haven't really gone away. I think that the Kunduz attack really consolidated Mullah Mansour's position. It strengthened him. But at the same time, they're going to be obstructionist forces within the Taliban.
Turning back to you, Lisa Curtis, and that leads us to whether or not the United States will slow the withdrawal of U.S. troops, as the top commander, General John Campbell, has now recommended. We were supposed to have left only approximately 1,000 troops by the end of 2016. So President Obama has to make a decision whether or not he will stick by his pledge or take a look at conditions on the ground which may militate for a greater U.S. troop presence. Where do you think that's going to go?
Well, I think General Campbell made a very important statement during his congressional testimony, and he said that the U.S. should maintain a residual force presence beyond 2016, but he did not specify a particular number. But the fact that he laid down his cards and indicated what he believed was necessary for the U.S. to do, I think this represents a turning point, and I don't think the White House will be able to maintain its position that, you know, we're going to go to zero troops by the end of 2016. They've said they would agree to, I guess, around 1,000, enough to protect the U.S. embassy. But even that is much too small to accomplish what the U.S. needs to accomplish in Afghanistan. I personally think the U.S. should maintain the 9,800 that are there now until we have more confidence that the Afghans can, in fact, maintain their own security presence. You know, I don't see any reason why we can't keep a robust force presence in a country from where the 9/11 attacks originated. We have the forces, and, you know, to me, it was always a politically driven decision by the Obama administration to go to this zero troops by the end of 2016 so that President Obama could claim to be the president that ended the war in Afghanistan. But I think the realities on the ground now dictate that we do leave a presence there. And I think we've seen a real turning point in terms of the U.S. military being clear on the U.S. need to do that.
Turning to you, Michael Kugelman, do you think, as Lisa said, this is a turning point and that the United States should reconsider its troop levels there as a result of what happened in Kunduz and leave a larger number of troops, almost 10,000, as Lisa Curtis is saying? What do you think the administration will do?
I think it's almost a definite that there's going to be a significant residual U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan after this year. I think in some ways the numbers, the troop levels are immaterial because, you know, let's face it, the height of the troop surge in 2011, the U.S. had 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, and it was not able to end the Taliban insurgency, and it was not even able to stabilize the country. So the numbers, I think, aren't as important as the fact that the troops are still there nonetheless. So I think that having a force of several thousand, whether it's 5,000 or just under 10,000 as there are now, you know, having those troops there is important because it would, among other things, provide a very strong psychological boost to the country and particularly to the Afghan security forces, which have been suffering from tremendous morale problems. The desertion rates within the Afghan security forces are unbelievable over the last few years. And knowing that there is going to be some form of a U.S. presence, even if they're not there fighting on the front lines, because any U.S. military presence in Afghanistan would, I would assume, remain as now, and then it would not be a combat presence. It would be meant for training, advice, limited counterterrorism activities. That still, in of itself, is very significant. And, you know, you look at the alternatives, this is sort of seen as an abstraction until recently. You know, there is the prospect of Afghanistan fully falling apart, of becoming fully destabilized. And if that were to happen, and I think there's pretty good chance of that happening if there's no U.S. military presence, then you could have a situation similar to what happened in the 1990s when Afghanistan became a very lawless place and al-Qaeda was able to establish sanctuaries to plot attacks on the United States. And that could well happen again down the road. So that's why I think the numbers aren't important. It's more the fact that there needs to be some level of a U.S. military presence.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Lisa Curtis, Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and Michael Kugelman, Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia in the Asia Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars here in Washington. Thanks so much to both of you for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Linus Rimkus. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.